Welcome to the Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. This is Episode 5, and I'm the co-founder and your host, Paul Rorschach-Tobin. With me tonight is co-founder Jesse Gitzman-Burke.
Hello.
And also on the panel are our regulars, Dan Crimson Avenger Carrick.
Hey, guys.
And Lester Crowe and his strolling bones.
Greetings from Canada.
Hey.
Wait, so Lester, you're Canadian? Wow, I didn't know that.
I sure am, eh?
Nice.
He was just talking about hockey.
I want some maple syrup.
Does your warrior carry a maple leaf shield?
No, my warrior carries a beaver.
Nice.
All right. I'm gonna put a halt right there before we go completely off the rails and this turns into a 3-hour podcast and I have to hit the for mature audiences only flag. So I gotta call time out right there. So, we're back with episode 5 here. We've got another great episode for you. In the system spotlight, we're going to talk about talents and skills. And then for our main topic, we're actually going to move a little bit away from maybe specific Warhammer stuff in general and talk a little bit more about role-playing and talk about how to create a balanced character and how to, as a GM, to run a balanced adventure. And then, of course, we're going to wrap things up with your questions. But first, we're going to start off with the news. And so we've got basically the one big thing about news that's come out in the last 2 weeks since our last episode is that the Omens of War has been officially announced. So that's the third supplement in the Ruinous Powers cycle that Fantasy Flight is doing. And this one is focused not just on Khorne as the Ruinous Power, but also military aspects of things. So.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this one. I know a lot of people, this seems to be like a fan favorite, and we had said earlier that Khorne tends to be the most popular of the Chaos Gods, so it's really no surprise that this is the one people are really getting a feverish about.
Still don't get why people like Khorne more than they like Nurgle, but I do agree that what I'm speculating the content to include is, really juicy. I'm pretty excited myself.
Well, it's really because Khorne's the only one that has demons named after favorite American food.
Exactly.
Corn dog.
The Burger King Khorne or
the corn dog.
The corn dog, that's right.
Or the flesh hound of Khorne, I guess is its more formal name.
That's
the only Warhammer joke I know. It's not even a joke.
So they did tease just a little bit in their announcement. They talked about specifically that there's going to be severe injuries, which are deadly cards similar to critical wounds. However, they're potentially permanent and debilitating wounds.
So these are things like lost hand or lost eye, that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. like that we remember from second edition.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
So if critical wounds weren't bad enough, now they've got these.
And try to take my arm.
Try to charm the princess when your nose has been lopped off, right?
So how do you kind of think that these, how are characters going to gain these? Is it going to be kind of like, critical wounds, maybe build up and eventually if you get enough of them, maybe they turn into a debilitating wound, kind of like how you have insanities, you have a temporary insanity that can become permanent. How do you think players are going to actually receive these?
I don't know how you can temporarily remove somebody's hand.
Right. That's why I'm kind of wondering from a game mechanic perspective, how do you kind of anticipate, you know, there really is no rules built into the game at all right now to suffer a wound of that magnitude. So what kind of game mechanic is going to be behind receiving these, do you think?
I think these may just be like wound cards. The back of them may be wound and then you shuffle them into the deck. And then if you draw one and it's a critical wound, woe is you, you know? You break your leg or your eye is
open. Oh, so you're thinking that you'll just shuffle them into your deck and there's just a chance that your wound is really, really sucky?
Yeah, like if you just shuffle all the severe injuries into the deck and then if you get a critical hit and the card happens to be one of the severe injuries, well then, too bad for your character.
That would work. That's simple and easy.
Yeah, and it does add some more realism to the game. I mean, come on, you can only take so many injuries before you're actually going to hurt yourself and break a leg.
Well, yeah, exactly.
That's something I loved about second edition is you'd get like, you know, fingers and hands cut off and you'd get like debilitating scars and things like that just make you socially unacceptable.
But that's where I was going to go mechanically. Second edition, if I remember that correctly, you only start getting critical wounds after you run out of hit points. So once you get down to zero hit points, you start getting those debilitating critical wounds in second edition. So that'd be my guess, is that you draw from the critical wound deck until you're down, your wound threshold is down to zero. And then when your wound threshold goes below zero and you take a critical wound, you draw from the serious injury deck instead.
Did they indicate how many serious injuries there would be?
No, the rundown that they've got is 50 action cards, 20 creature cards, 10 careers, 40 stand-ups, and then they do new miscellaneous condition, location, item, mutation, talent, and severe injury cards.
So if they follow kind of the formula of similar amount of content to previous expansions, we can probably expect, you know, a deck of 15 or 20. Give or take a little bit would be my guess. Which maybe, if that's the case, maybe Lester's concept might be more appropriate. It may not be a full deck of like 30 or 40 cards, because they would probably mention it in the number of cards up above if it was a substantial number.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's still speculation at this point, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Really anything about it. They'll probably announce it as time goes on. They'll start giving us little snippets of pieces of this product. I mean, what was it? You were saying, how long do we have to wait, Paul?
So it's listed as at the printers. So they on the website that they say it could take anywhere from a month to 3 months to get printed. And then it's shipped, which is anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks to Fantasy Flight. And then it's 7 to 10 days from Fantasy Flight to distribute it out to stores. So I think at best we're looking at 2 months probably.
Yeah.
Speaking of speculation, they did show the cover art for the box set, which shows a Chaos Knight of Khorne running, which is one of the new things. They add mounted combat, along with a bunch of new martial careers and presumably some advanced martial careers. But then a little further down, they give you a little snapshot of a couple of the tokens and action cards. Let's see, one of them is the Scaling Charge, which is a melee action card. The other one, which looks like a ranged attack, dangerous modifications. Let's see, that's the,
No, actually, I think that that's the other thing. That's the other thing that they teased, is that there's a way to do, mods to your actions. The enhanced, while new enhanced cards give you more thematic control over your fighting style. So I think that's a preview of one of those enhancements.
Well, you can look at the top left icon. The one on the right, the green one, looks like it has that pistol that is the icon for range, but it could be, but it also has a background of what looks like a Sigmar's Comet. So you're right. That might be something new, because it's partially covered.
Now, you know, I have a question. As Paul, you've played, second edition. Jesse, you played second as well, right?
Oh, it says enhances a ranged attack. Well, I'm reading it here. You're right, Paul. The green one is an example of one of the enhanced cards. Go ahead, Dan. I'm sorry to cut you off.
No, I was just asking since you two both played second, I'm not sure, Lester, if you played second as well, but are you guys happy to see a lot of stuff that was pretty relevant in second edition start to kind of appear in third edition, that's really kind of starting to broad out the whole spectrum of third edition?
It seems like they're really still hitting those core elements that have to be hit before they can go out into the fringes and explore some of the other content. You know, they have to hit all four chaos powers early on before they're really able to do a whole lot else. Then we'll probably see Blackfire Pass is coming soon, which is going to be dwarves and most likely greenskins. We'll probably see something regarding Skaven shortly after that. And then we'll probably see wood elves and high elves kind of come into play. But, you know, I'm certain they're going to have to hit kind of the core elements in each expansion. And they're still kind of stuck in that rut. They're making great stuff, but we're not going to be seeing new exciting things that are duplicating content yet. They still need to hit each of the core elements before they can broaden the horizons a bit further.
Do you think they're gonna start a campaign? Do you think they're gonna start like a lead up to the Storm of Chaos, or, you know, the Enemy Within third edition or something like that?
I think they're getting close.
I don't know. I was wondering, you know, it's kind of hard to dedicate. I mean, considering if they release something once every 3 months or so, how long will it take them to still cover the basics if they're going to be allocating resources to developing, you know, multi-part campaigns? I would envision, you know, but they still got things like the undead to cover, and they potentially the Khemri, they got ogres, they got maybe halflings. We even have a question about that a bit later. So,
well, they promised halflings, so that's probably going to come relatively soon. Some people are saying maybe even the Slaanesh
yeah,
box. But
that'd be my guess, the Slaanesh one, yeah.
Makes the most sense, because, I mean, they're really, you know, they're into excessive.
Gluttonous.
Yeah, exactly, and thievery and things like that, so.
Yeah, you're right, though. I mean, if, you know, considering the speed that they put out, that they put out content, you know, if they do something like a Storm of Chaos or Enemy Within third edition, you know, it'd take the better part of 2 years to probably get it all out. But that's okay because we've got everything from the old stuff. I actually went over a bunch of my first edition stuff, figuring out what I wanted to do. Since Jesse, you're wrapping up the Eye for an Eye adventure that we've been putting out on the podcast, and gonna pass the torch on to me. And I think I'm gonna go with the Gathering Storm though, and kick that off. Maybe not do the entire campaign, but definitely, you know, sink our teeth into Stromdorf.
So. Hey, can I bounce back to the Omens of War for a quick sec?
Yeah,
I'm still looking at the picture on the website of the two cards and a bunch of the stand-ups, and I do recall there being some debate on the forums over what they're showing as the stand-up cards. I just wanted to go over four of the cards that we know we're going to get. Certainly you have a Fleshhound of Khorne, which you already have one of if you have the core set. But we also look like we have a Cultist of Khorne, and then you have two large creatures behind them. Certainly one of them is a Bloodthirster. Now, it's a little difficult to tell which one it is. Most likely the one on the left with the wings and the big double-bladed axe is the Bloodthirster. The black one is most likely a Demon Prince of Khorne. But, you know, it's kind of hard to tell which one's which. They both have a lot of traits of Bloodthirsters and or Demon Princes, and given how close up they are. But that's going to be great to have another one, a third greater demon to be able to throw into your games. So I'm very excited about that.
Well, and they've done that before. I mean, specifically with Winds of Magic and Tzeentch, you know, you had things like the Herald that were in there, you know, that isn't necessarily one of your regular sets of demons. So I think that might be, you know, the Khorne version of that extra demon, that Herald or what have you.
Well, the Heralds, if I remember correctly from the Warhammer tabletop, are more or less human-sized, give or take. You know, they're more the they're kind of, I don't think they're necessarily the giant monsters that we're used to as far as the greater demons. Demon princes are certainly large. But I had some confusion with the Nurgle stand-ups too, where, you know, they almost had two stand-ups that both looked like the Great Unclean One. You know, maybe you're a lot, maybe God, maybe you can have two, but you certainly could. But I'm really wondering where they're going with these ones that really, really look similar, allowing you to do maybe a Demon Prince and a Greater Demon of each one, and then maybe another one for the Herald, because the Herald for Tzeentch is actually not either of the large creatures. It's actually a normal-sized one.
Uh-huh.
And I have one more question concerning Omens of War before we move on here. It kind of comes from a post on the forums here where they were speculating about how many new martial action cards there will be, because they announced that there's going to be 50 action cards. But from my perspective, most of those action cards are going to be for the monsters, not for the players.
I don't know about 20, most, but... You know,
there's 20 new creatures. There's 20 new creatures, so
you're right.
At least half of those cards are going to be for the creatures, I think.
I'd say at least half. But remember, those action cards, I think, include the enhancement cards are in that pile. Those 50.
Oh, okay.
So I think you're going to get a couple melee actions, you're going to get a couple range and a couple support, and then you're going to get a good size stack of enhancements, and then whatever's left over is going to be applicable to creatures.
Oh, okay.
And if you take a look, I mean, really, the number of actions that have come out for per creature isn't a whole lot. I mean, it's more like per creature type, you know, that comes out. So since this is another creature type, you know, the corn demons are basically all the creatures that are going to be included in this expansion, I bet you five, less than 10 of those action cards are going to be creature actions.
That's my guess. Something I was curious. Yeah, that was just something I was curious about.
Yeah. Lots of speculation on that one. So, going back to my cunningly ployed segue that got unraveled. the other bit of news that we're talking about is that we are wrapping up with our first adventure, the one that Jesse ran, Ifer and I. I'm going to be taking over as GM and running the Gathering Storm. So, we're looking for folks who are willing to, who have at least a player's guide worth of Warhammer 3rd edition material, have some availability on the weekends to play, and has a pretty good audio connection and map tools up and running. If you fit that bill, give us a shout on the site or send us an email, and, cause we're looking for a handful of people, maybe one or two people to join us.
Hey, Paul, I got my hand raised just in case.
Okay. All right.
You got one devoted fan.
As a plug, then you guys will send emails to recklessdice@gmail.com. That'd be the best place. We're going to keep a roster of people who have requested to be part of the games, and we'll send out a notification or something like that when we're ready to reach out.
I was just going to say one thing. For any new guys that are really wanting to try out the system, I strongly urge you guys to do this because, Paul, I've heard you're a great GM. So I think this will allow some people that, you know, maybe don't have any gaming groups in their local area, but they have the books. I think this will really open up doors to get people really into the game. I know it did for me, so.
Especially internationally too, if anybody, likes to play internationally and can accommodate the timing schedule that we have, you know, really no problems there. We've done it in the past, it works real well.
Yeah, touching back on what Dan said, that's really been my experience. Like, it's been nice to have someone to play with, because, I mean, I don't really have a good gaming group here, so it's nice. It's a good opportunity for anybody who wants to play.
And you don't have to leave your home.
and if you can't get in, you can also listen to it too. I mean, there's stuff that I learned just from Jesse, you running through our group, and, you know, other actual play podcasts that are out there. I don't think anybody else is doing a Warhammer or a Warhammer 3rd edition one that I know of. But
I think the only thing you managed to learn from my games was how to correct me on the rules that I was doing wrong. And I say that with love. I don't say that out of resentment.
You know, yeah, but you know, it's easy to talk on the outside. When the mic starts up in a week or two, you know, we'll see. I'm sure I will make a whole new.
I'm gonna have my cheat sheet in front of me, ready to call you on it.
Absolutely.
Paul, that's a black tie.
Oh, Paul, that's purple. Paul, purple.
All right. So I think that wraps it up for the news. So we're gonna take a quick break, and then when we come back, we're gonna talk about talents and skills in our system spotlight. And we're back. So this time, this episode in the System Spotlight, we're going to highlight another aspect of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition, kind of the mechanics side of things. This time around, we're going to talk about talents and skills. So we'll kick things off with skills. Now, skills have been a staple of RPGs pretty much since, what, like 2nd Edition Dungeons & Dragons, maybe 3rd Edition Dungeons & Dragons. I mean, pretty much you don't even... There's very few, unless you're getting very esoteric, RPG systems out there that don't have skills. It's your innate ability, which is referenced by your characteristics, plus your knowledge and training, which is represented by your skills, equals your ability or your success at doing something. So, the way that Warhammer 3rd Edition handles it is that they have a pretty well-defined set of skills, broken down into basic and advanced. So the basic skills are actually right there on the character sheet for you, because everybody can use the basic skills. So everybody has athletics, everybody has charm, everybody has intuition, all of those sorts of things. But then there's another set of skills, and those are also well-defined, which are the advanced skills. And unless you actually train in those skills, you don't even have a hope of doing anything regarding that. So things like animal handling or spellcraft is an advanced skill.
Or education, which is kind of the reading and writing element for Warhammer, which is a big one. A lot of people forget that one when making their characters. Innately, your characters do not know how to read or write, and it's really only a select few educated people in the Warhammer world who have that ability, like a scribe, or most wizards, or educated folk.
Yep, absolutely. So mechanically, the way that skills work is that every skill is associated with characteristics. So weapon skill is associated with strength. Ballistic skill is associated with agility. Folklore is associated with intelligence. If you have that skill, so either it's a basic skill or you've acquired the skill if it's an advanced skill, by having that skill means you just roll your characteristics. So if you innately have weapon skill, so if you need to make a weapon skill test, like you're trying to hit somebody, then you just basically roll your strength straight up. For example, with education as well. So if there's something that you need to do, a test for education, if you've acquired the education skill, which not everybody has, then you can roll intelligence to do an education check.
Now, advanced skills have, you can learn an advanced skill but not have any check marks in it. There is a difference between having it available to you to use and being trained in it. So
right.
You can, unlike basic skills where anybody can try them, trained or not, you really, once you're trained in them, you are just better at it and proficient. Advanced skills you cannot try until you learn that skill, and then as you train yourself in it beyond the basics of just learning it, you then become proficient in it.
The terminology the rules use is the term acquired. So you acquire advanced skills, and then that allows you to make a check in it. But then once you train your advanced skills or you train a basic skill, that's when you get the bonus. And the bonus is you get the yellow die. You get the you get the expertise die. And that's the only die that includes two symbols on it that includes the Sigmar's Comet, which is the critical success or critical side success. Mm-hmm. And it also includes the righteous success, which is the hammer with the plus sign. And that's the only die that explodes, basically. If you roll the hammer with the plus sign, then you re-roll that expertise die and add that, result to your previous result.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So it's a pretty big deal. I mean, being able to roll that extra expertise die is a pretty significant probability bump to getting a successful test.
When and it's the expertise die is immensely more positive statistically than a fortune die or even a statistics die. Is that right?
Oh yeah. On the expertise dice, there's only one blank side. Everything else is positive. It positively affects your the task at hand. And a fortune die is you got a 1 in 2 chance, I believe. It's 3 out of 6.
Yeah.
Yep. And that is the same thing as well for just a blue D8. The characteristic die is a 3 in 6 chance or 4 in 8 chance of getting a success. So yeah, it is a big deal. And in fact, so much that you cannot, so there's levels of training that you have with your character. You can only train a skill up to your rank.
And when you say training, you're talking about that checkbox that's next to the skills.
Now, I have a question. You know, as most people are new gamers, I mean, I think we've talked about this quite a while ago, but, you know, since we're on the topic of skills, what would you guys perceive as a good start for anyone, you know, who's creating a character? What are really ones that they should look at that maybe are overlooked and possibly, I mean, maybe just name a few?
You know, let's save that, Dan, for the main topic, because that actually gets a little bit into designing your character to fit a fun role-playing game, and I want to save a couple of concepts we have for that.
And it's a great idea. Just at the start, though, your career defines how easy it is to train your skills. So your career has certain skills defined, usually 4, I think. And
there's 5.
There's 5? Okay, so
five,
those.
Yeah.
So those five skills, you spend one advancement to train that skill. If you don't have, if you're doing a non-career skill, it's going to cost two to train or two to acquire if it's an advanced skill. So really your career kind of defines what your skills are.
And then there's also these specializations that each skill has.
Right. So that's the extra bonus that you can have on that. So the specializations are specific instances or specific conditions that allows you to add a fortune die to your skill role. So for example, the charm skill has for specializations. And again, I kind of like that Warhammer does a nice job of defining them for you. A lot of other places it doesn't define, and it kind of leaves it up to you, like what's a misfortune die? When does a fortune die come into play? But in this case, they specifically tell you what are all the advanced skills, all the basic skills, and what all the specializations are for those skills. So for example, charm, you've got etiquette, gossip, diplomacy, haggling, and seduction. So if you have the charm skill trained and you have a specialization in haggling, then when you're haggling for the price of that new sword, you roll both an expertise die and a fortune die along with your fellowship.
And whatever other gets applied to the dice pool.
Right, everything else that gets applied to the dice pool. But if you're doing something like gossip or diplomacy, things like that, then you're just rolling the expertise die and not the misfortune or the fortune die.
So it's just a further refinement of your training in that skill type.
Yeah, and it's my understanding that the rules actually encourage creative thinking here. It encourages players to come up with their own specializations, and as long as the game master is okay with what you've decided, then you can basically pick whatever you want for your specializations. You're not limited by the ones that they list in the rule book, is what I'm trying to get.
That's what I like about it too.
Cool.
Yeah, they're definitely guidelines, but not comprehensive. But I think they're relatively comprehensive. I don't know. Maybe I haven't played enough to dig into a specialization that I'd like that isn't already on the list.
They don't tell you how you should build your character. They give you the opportunity to do it and then let the game master know, you know, hey, if it's something that you want to allow in your game, then yes. But it pretty much lets the bars fall and you get to create your own path and design your character.
Cool. So I think that kind of covers skills. Is there anything that I missed in there?
What if you're trying to do a skill that is or perform a some kind of maneuver or something with your character that is not covered by the categories of skills that are, you know, provided here in the master skill list?
You know, then one of the things is maybe it's just a straight up characteristic test, right? The usual the usual test of strength to open a stuck door or have an arm wrestling contest or something
the other thing that's going through my head is what happens when you're trying to perform an action where you might be combining things like a diving tackle or, you know, where you're using maybe athletics and strength and coordination all in one. Where do you go with that? Which one do you use? Do you break it up into separate roles? Do you pull out like the perform a stunt action?
Well, I mean, if you're in encounter mode, that's probably a perform a stun action. In terms of how I'd make a call as a GM on that, you know, if I'm feeling beneficial, you know, I'd take like the average of the two capabilities, right? Or maybe, you know, round up. So if you're trained in athletics, you know, but you're not trained in something else, you know, give them the expertise die versus not giving them the expertise die. I think if you're doing a combined action that combines two separate characteristics, then I'd probably think pretty hard about actually splitting that one up and, you know, doing your fellowship check and then your agility check versus both of them together. But then if you do that, then the probabilities of failing at that check increase quite a bit when you roll twice instead of once. So
yeah,
I don't know. That's a good question.
I usually let my players pick, like if it requires, let's say, both coordination and strength, well, then they pick which one they want to use, and I just make one roll. But they have to obviously role play or describe it in a manner that fits using, let's say, coordination because they're trained over strength. So in your example, Jesse, if they're running and they try to jump and tackle him, well, they'd have to explain why they're using their coordination to gain an advantage in that.
Okay, so you're saying maybe let the players kind of dictate what skills they're going to be using, or at least justify it, and then, you know, allow both the player and the GM to try and drive that scenario, and then allow the GM just kind of the, you know, veto power at the end and help kind of decide on an action.
Yeah, let them give some reasoning.
Yeah, I like Lester's idea to put the onus on the player to.
Well, that certainly encourages player interaction a little bit more too.
Yeah. Well, if you're coming in and rolling, like let's say it does require strength. I mean, like common sense says it requires strength and agility. Well, you're just going to mire your game down with rolling all these pools of dice. So I just let the players figure out how they want to go about accomplishing the task, and then, you know, give them a couple options. Well, you could use your agility there, or you could use your strength, whichever one you feel fits better, you know?
Well, I guess the other solution there is you nail it. When you have this kind of multiple skilled action you're trying to perform, you can rely on one, maybe the most prominent skill, or the one the player wants to use, and then add an appropriate number of misfortune dice.
Exactly.
To compensate for it instead of trying to overcomplicate it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it requires some strength too, so here's two misfortune dice as well. But exactly. You can use your better skill. Like, you're trained in coordination, and you got to choose to use that. So, I'll give you a little bit of a penalty.
That's one part I love about this game, is the flexibility of how you can approach to solve problems as a GM.
It's like
there will always be an answer, and it's just a matter of how many misfortune dice to add.
It's a barter system, essentially, right? You have a barter system, and the player can say, I want my character to do this. Then you can give them a cost. If they don't agree with the cost, well, they don't have to do the action, right?
Mm-hmm. So what about these talent cards, then?
So talents are a real cool thing that I like in this game. Talents are – they're analogous to feats in Dungeons & Dragons. They're kind of abilities that are there. There are innate abilities and knacks and bonuses that you have that are associated with your character. So they're sometimes a little more passive than a skill. It's something that's built into your character. And I know one of the things that's always been a problem mechanically with Dungeons and Dragons, and other systems that have these kind of feats or talents built into them, is that you can kind of game the system. You can have feats tie off of each other and really potentially get into some really broken places. So the way that Warhammer 3rd Edition gets around that is that you're not limited in the number of talents that you have, but you are limited in the number of talents that you can have active at any one time. So talents are broken into basically four main categories. You have the tactics, which are kind of more combat focused. And then you have the focus talents, which are more intellectual, and then reputation talents, which are social. And then the fourth category is special talents. And those special talents are things like, if you're a spellcasting class, your order, your faith winds up in those. And then things like the zealot gets insanity as a special talent that they're able to slot. So your character sheet actually has sockets for, if you've got a basic character, for two talents. And then advanced, one of the cool things about advanced careers versus basic careers is that you've got three talent slots. So, for example, the Road Warden has a reputation slot and a tactic slot. So you may have multiple talents, but you can only have one of those active at a time. So it really prevents people from doing that extra stacking and potentially breaking your game.
Hmm. Okay.
Now, talent cards have a whole variety of different benefits that they can use. Some of them are just passive abilities that they give your character in certain scenarios. Other ones are talent cards that you actually activate and exhaust them for the act or the session you're on. Is that right?
Yeah. So if a talent is always active, if a talent is passive in nature, then you're really only going to get like a misfortune die's worth of benefit out of it. But it happens all the time. So, for example, there's a reputation talent called Gregarious, and it basically allows you to add a fortune die to all charm checks, right? So it's always there, it's always a little boost, and you don't need to worry about it. But if you charge it, if you actually exhaust a card, a talent card, or in other cases, add a fortune point, spend a fortune point to do it, then you're going to get either like a success or like two fortune dice worth of benefits. So the connected reputation card, for example, if you exhaust the card, you add two fortune dice to your dice pool when using a social action. And when you exhaust a talent, it's like when you use an action card. You flip over the card, it's inactive, and you've got four recharge tokens on the card.
Now, one of the other elements of is that you can take those talent cards, and instead of socketing them onto your player sheet, you can socket them onto the party sheet. I know we're going to kind of touch on the party sheets in a later system spotlight, but essentially the group then benefits from, you know, what talent you're socketing on the group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is an awesome thing for that extra talent that you're not going to use, but you want to get
the benefit.
Because
it's very conceivable over time you'll have more talents than your character card allows you to slot. Because at a maximum, I think it's three at a time.
Yeah.
So, you know, as you become a second generation character or a second tier character, you may have three, four, maybe even five, talent cards available to you.
But you can swap those out during combat by using maneuvers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in story
mode, you could technically switch between them by suffering stress. So if you needed to, say, one of them, there's one on here that allows you to gain stress by exhausting the card. Like, you remove stress by exhausting the card? So you could technically use that in tandem to break the game, I guess. But it's much different. It's much more difficult.
The fact that you
benefits.
Have to exhaust things in order to gain their benefits, unless it's a passive ability, really makes it a little difficult to get a game breaking benefit out of it.
Yeah,
and even if you do get it, it's going to be a temporary one.
If you exhaust a talent, you can't swap it out. You can't swap out exhausted talents.
Yeah. Yeah. It has to recharge before you can swap it back out.
Yeah, only active talents can be swapped.
But you can use your fortune points and things like that in order to remove recharge tokens. Just expedite that process.
Yep.
Okay, cool. See, I was going to actually ask you that question, if you can swap out an exhausted card, but that is the rule, you can't. Okay,
yep. Sweet. See, we'll learn how to play eventually. We sort of keep asking Paul.
Thanks, Paul.
Yeah,
Paul's
no
the
problem.
God of Warhammer. You didn't know that?
No, I didn't.
He's Sigmar.
All hail Sigmar Tovia.
I like to read a lot.
Me too, man.
Again, yeah,
I read it. I just don't retain it as well.
Yeah, I don't either.
I look at the pictures.
See, that's what you get for college education. Can't retain the information.
So there's actually some other mechanics, some kind of advanced mechanics that go in with talents as well. For example, when you've got your small but vicious dog, the abilities of your dog are actually counted as talents, a special kind of talent called a trick. So when you get your animal companion, you've got a certain number of trick slots for that animal companion, and then you choose tricks like talents to have your dog to be able to do the, you know, man's best friend versus the bite and shake move or things like that. And then the last thing, and we'll go into it when we talk about damage and things like that in a future system spotlight, is when you get a disease, using the disease rules, a disease takes up one of your talent slots. You get less talents that you have active
and disease.
and all the fun of the disease there as well. So, yeah.
Ooh, do you think crippling wounds might do something like that too?
I was wondering the same thing.
That's a very good idea. Yeah,
that would be pretty cool.
So you're diseased and you've got a serious injury. So
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you're in rough shape, man.
And you're insane, and you've got a mutation, but you know you got all your hit points, so it's all right.
Yeah. And at that point, you were a regular citizen of the Empire.
Yeah, exactly. At that point, you're just the regular bum, you know, trying to get some change on the corner.
Cool. See, man. All right. Some more, you become the Oliver of the Warhammer world.
Oliver.
All right. That's
all I've got for skills and talents. Did we miss anything or any
I questions? Think that was pretty good.
Yeah, all right. I think we touched it.
So we'll take another quick break, and then on the other side, we'll come back with our main topic. And we're back. So we're in the main topic of our episode for tonight, and we're going to get into a little bit more of the art of role-playing, I guess. It's a topic that I brought up for the panel to discuss. And one of the things, I guess one of my, not necessarily a pet peeve, but one of the things that I think, certain people do when they get into role playing is that they limit themselves to one style and don't, enjoy the breadth of what the role playing experience is about. So when I was trying to break down what do you do when you play a role playing game, maybe an oversimplification, but I kind of broke it down into three things that you do. One is combat, which is that physical struggle or physical test of domination, one person beating another person. There's the social, which is kind of the intellectual side of combat, and that's actually kind of done mechanically as encounter mode in Warhammer, as encounter mode can be done either socially or combat based. And then kind of the third leg of the triangle or the third side of the triangle, the third leg of the stool is investigation. And investigation can be mental. You know, you're figuring out a puzzle, you're doing research, or it can be physical where you're talking about Tomb Raidering, Indiana Jones, all that kind of stuff. So,
different role-playing games kind of offer a different focus in that triangle of more social, more investigation, or more combat. So one could argue that, like, D&D is more combat-focused than social or investigation, while maybe Call of Cthulhu is more investigation-based and social-based than combat-based.
Definitely.
And yeah, there's definitely a predilection of.
So where do you think Warhammer falls in that little triangle of adventure?
I think Warhammer can fall wherever you want it to.
Depends on the GM.
It absolutely depends on the GM in the game, but I think that you get the most out of it, the most variety out of things when you're willing to go in all three directions. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, some of the first role-playing games that I did or stuff, you know, that I did in college when, you know, it'd be a Saturday night, we're all drunk and stuff like that. It'd just be a dungeon crawl, right? Mm-hmm. We'd just bash through room after room after room, and there was just, you know, maybe a little bit of investigation, but primarily combat.
Yeah, your investigation would typically come about when you're searching a room for treasure or disarming traps.
Yeah, after kind of you killed everybody, you right. do a little bit of investigation. Yeah, I find most people like the combat. Like, most new players that I've tried to introduce the game to have really leaned a little bit more towards combat. They're more comfortable in it. I find a lot of people have difficulty being comfortable in social situations, and other people aren't clever enough to figure out some of the investigative
things.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, for myself, when I started playing a game with Jesse, I was more into packing things up and having fun. And then other people are like, all right, well, I'm going to go explore this. And I'm like, oh, you can explore too? You know, you just, when you start playing the game, you think, oh, I'm just in it to win it and kill, and how many heads do I lop off? And you never really think of that other aspect of there's also the exploring aspect. So
I think as a new player, it's easier to judge your success in a game that you're unfamiliar with through combat. You survived a combat. You have hit points, you do damage, there's more rules, mechanics centered around combat than really any other part of most role-playing games. So it's an easy part to latch onto as opposed to the social or investigation, which are much more ambiguous and very much role-playing driven, which is, even though you are playing a role-playing game, a lot of people really are just playing a board game with role-playing elements. The social and investigation part really encourages the role-playing aspects of it.
See, and I'll even go you one better on that. I mean, if you're playing a role-playing game and you're just doing combat, why aren't you playing WoW?
Exactly. You're not playing a role-playing game at all. It's like, that's the one thing I try to encourage when introducing new players is that it's not, you're not winning the game. There's no winning. You can never win the game. We are here to develop characters and create a story mutually as a team. So, I try to limit combat actually, but it inevitably leads to somebody in a bar or at the inn or whatever starting a fight, because that is most people's most appealing, leg of the triangle, I guess.
As people play, I think the more sophisticated a player becomes and the more they get exposed to role-playing games, you actually tend to prefer to lean away from combat and more into the social and investigation sections, because those tend to be the most content-rich, and combat tends to be a little more dry and boring at times, as opposed to maybe it's the flip side of the coin for new players.
Yeah.
But I think the key is being a GM and creating your own adventures and things like that is having that variety. I mean, yeah. You know, and when you're running the game as well, having that understanding as a GM, at what point has the investigation bogged down so it's time for the cultists to kick in the door?
Exactly.
You know, or vice versa, you know, that they've slogged through, that they've had this, you know, that they've had this massively draining combat and just got out with the skin of their teeth. Let's take a break now. Let's do a social encounter. You know, let's talk to the high elf maidens or something, you know, something like that at that point.
Man, our poor PCs on our eye for an eye game right now. I think our entire last session was an encounter that has outside of a couple rally steps and a couple brief separations from combat has been a chase into combat into chase. And that's been an interesting one, even just to try and conceive a way to stop the encounter from happening. But that's been a fun adventure to watch it kind of derail. But Eye for an Eye adventure is a great example of combat social investigation.
Yeah, it's a perfect trifecta. It can go so many ways. It's incredible.
Now, did you choose combat social investigation in order to tie into the three-act thing that they're drilling in so hard?
Not necessarily, you know, it was just kind of something I might have read something, you know, a while back, but that's just, you know, just trying to break down, you know, what is the core actions? What is the core things?
You're certainly right. It is the three pillars of role-playing game. You're absolutely right.
Any role-playing game, exactly. That's what I like about Warhammer 2, though, going back just quickly to that combat being the most favored, is that in Warhammer, you're actually not encouraged to fight because it's extremely dangerous. Your character can die very easily.
As we found that one poor dude who met his grisly end.
I know, and I'm really prepared to have the character I'm playing run at the slightest chance that he's gonna die, you know.
Well, and that's kind of what I wanted to get into on the second side of that. So we kind of talked about, you know, if you're a GM or if you're making adventures, you know, I think there's some real value in going into that variety and trying to mix things up and not have things just be combat focused or just investigative focused, but do a mix of all three. So if you're playing in a campaign that's along those lines that has all three of those, then you want to make sure that your character can participate in those three as well. Now, you may have a focus or a speciality in combat if you're a pit fighter or a bounty hunter or something like that, but don't sell yourself short when it comes to social actions or when it comes to investigation, right?
As an example of characters of that type, Paul, when we begin the game that you're going to be running, I'm going to try and use my town guard character that I had developed a little while ago, but you know, he's a town guard who's kind of a fighter, but I actually decided I didn't really want to be a melee focused character though. I wanted him to be kind of that friendly town guard who is a little bit more of a breaking up fights and is the guy everybody says hi to, instead of the guy who goes around and beats heads. So I actually spent a lot more focus in his stats, in his social skills.
Just being not a fighter, that's not good. Just kidding.
I mean, he can still fight, but it's not his specialty. He's much more of a diplomatic city guard.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dan.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that's kind of cool. You know, I never thought. I mean, when I first created my character, it was a pit fighter. Why? Because I wanted to fight. Now I'm thinking about doing a different character, kind of the line that you're doing. because I want to immerse myself in a different role. So,
you know, some of the famous ones that a lot of people like to do once they've tried a fighter and want to back off of that a little bit and be a little more well-rounded are things like tomb robbers, gamblers.
Rogues. Sure.
People who can fight but also really specialize in that investigation element, observing and sneaking around.
Yeah, I want to make a gambler.
I think that there's ways that you can have a career that may look like it's focused on one thing, but be able to do stuff like you did, Jesse, with your soldier, with your town guard. You know, back to you, Dan, with your pit fighter. Pit fighters are the Warhammer equivalent of professional wrestlers. So what about playing a Warhammer luchador? Somebody with style and stuff like that, right? So you've got, you know, in those social actions, you're boisterous. You know, you're going up and you're Randy Macho Man savaging, you know, oh yeah, all right, you know, up into the
Yeah, I helped a friend create a character. He has never played a tabletop role-playing game before, but he has a basic concept. And he ended up creating a character actually very similar to what you guys are talking about there. He had he had guile as one of his skills, and he specialized in boasting. So his character was really good at boasting things that he may or may not have done in the past to trick people, maybe to get them to pay more money when they're gambling on his matches or whatever.
Well, some people, what they like to do in order to maybe assist in figuring out an interesting side trait to your character, you know, some people love it, some people hate it, is coming up with a little bit of a backstory on how your character got to where they are now. And, you know, what that does is it helps, even if you don't have something in mind, as you're coming up with this backstory, it may start leaning your character in a certain style or direction that you hadn't thought of before when initially conceiving it. So I would encourage people, even if you don't write it down, you know, try and come up with something so it'll give you some ideas on how to be a more effective character.
And always think of your character separate from your career. Your character is driven by other motivations necessarily than just your career, you know?
Yeah, you could be the bloodthirsty innkeeper who has aspirations of being a professional gambler.
Yeah.
And going back to what you said, Jesse, I think the 10 questions that are actually in the rules isn't bad. You know, where are you from? What's your family like? What's your social class? What'd you do before you became an adventurer? Why did you become an adventurer? How religious are you? Who are your friends and family? Who are your enemies and friends? What's your prized possessions? Who are you loyal to? And who do you love or hate? You know, if
those
you
are
just,
great questions. You don't have to answer all of them. You don't even have to write them all down. But I mean, those are things to keep in mind. If you answer even just 3 of those, I can guarantee you're going to have a character that has some style to it.
And depth. Yeah, for sure. And I noticed that the expanded character sheet actually gave you an option to put who your enemies and who your friends are on it and everything like that, which is, that helps add flavor, I guess.
So, and I think the flip side of that is something that I'll tell all my players is that if you're playing a role-playing game and I'm your GM, you need to have your characters be danger-worthy. You know, you don't have to be a combat god, but when the shit hits the fan, you know, you can't always go hide underneath the table. So being that kind of danger worthy. And I kind of go back to the characters of Warhammer, Felix and Gotrek, right? Felix is not the combat god. Gotrek is, but still in those stories, Felix still pulls out his sword and runs through a couple beastmen and mutants, you know, when it comes down to it, even though he's, you know, his original career was a student. But he also liked dueling, you know, he was a noble and things like that. So there's things that you can build in. Warhammer is the old world is a nasty place. Everybody's going to know how to take care of themselves, even if you are a student or a scholar or an innkeeper or something like that. So making sure that your character can hold a sword, I think is just as important as having a pit fighter who can do a social encounter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they just do social encounters differently.
I mean, there's all sorts of things you can use in combat, too, to your advantage, like with the ability to substitute a maneuver to aid, a fellow. You can, even if you're not really the one laying down most of the damage, you can stay in an engagement with one of your party members and assist them in dealing the majority of the damage and giving them a better chance of hitting and stuff like that, while you make your feeble attempts at doing whatever. Or you could distract them with your guile or whatever. There's all sorts of things you can do in combat besides hide under a table, right? Regardless of your career.
Absolutely. So, anything else that we wanted to cover in that? I think we've kind of got both sides of that.
That was a good cover on characters. We'll probably touch on characters continually throughout our different episodes as we start weaving all these different topics together.
Yeah, sounds good. All right, so we're going to take our last quick break, and then on the other side, it's going to be your questions.
And we're back. As always, you can submit your questions in written or audio format to recklessdice@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter @recklessdice. Our first question comes from Sebastian Sturz, and he emailed into us. I'm not sure what I would think about the rules where you armor adds misfortune dice to get hit. Why is it difficult to hit me just because I wear armor? He's wondering what's the reasoning behind this. So just to kind of clarify that rule for everybody, your defense value adds that number of misfortune dice to the attack rolls against you. So if you have your soak value reduces the amount of damage you take, so if you have defense 2, you're going to be getting the purple dice in order to make the attack, a number of black dice equal to the number of your defense plus any other modifiers for the dice pool and the action cards being used. What's your guys' take on why you add black dice to make it difficult to hit him?
I don't know. I wonder why agility, you know how toughness and soak add up together to negate how much damage you take?
Mm-hmm.
It's really curious to me why they didn't work agility into an ability to dodge apart from giving you access to the dodge card. You know?
My take on it is that you probably actually, I think he's getting hung up on actually getting hit, like physically knocking somebody over the head. And I think you should take a step back and look at it from a little bit higher level of this is an engagement and this is how difficult it was to not only land a blow, but land an effective blow. So you might hit somebody on the shoulder pad in one hit, but you might get through the armor on the next hit. So it kind of wraps all those concepts together to make so your armor does protect you and make you harder to land effective blows on you.
Mm-hmm. The way I kind of look at it is like a cloak or the wizard robes, right? Those mm-hmm. only provide defense; they don't provide soak. Maybe your strike gets tangled up in it, or you thought you hit him, but you really hit the cloak or a fold of the robe or something like that.
Exactly.
I think
right. Going back to that kind of landing the effective blow.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a mechanical fudge. I mean, I know where you're coming from, Lester, saying that, you know, why doesn't agility fit into it and those sorts of things. And honestly, I think, and you know, I'm playing a little bit of armchair RPG designer right here. It just comes down to a mechanical thing. It just comes down to, you know, there's a certain average target for probabilities to hit and, you know, wizards get hit too easily. So let's give a little defense to robes. But, you know, we don't want people putting a bunch of their character points into agility because you have to have that to have any kind of defense, for your characters. So, I understand where the question's coming from to bring that around, but there's been a long, long, long history. I mean, the original, Thaco armor class, right? Mm-hmm. With D&D first mm-hmm. edition, armor was just about getting hit, not about mitigating damage.
Yeah, absolutely. So our next question comes from Jeremy from Paris. He asks, don't you think the global combat difficulty level is too easy based on the number of blue dice versus purple dice in the pool? And he gives some examples here. A regular Ungor of strength 4 has a 72% chance to hit his brave, in quotations, troll slayer dwarf, who has no armor and then takes 4 damage almost automatically. as a huge Warhammer 2nd Edition fan, he remembers low-level NPCs, such as Ungors, had a max of 40% chance to hit, and then the target character had various ways of annihilating that hit or mitigating it, and he signs off from Paris with boons. So what do you guys think about the higher percentage chance of scoring successful hits in Warhammer as in general? Because I think it's pretty much across the board. Your chance of success in this game is pretty high.
I think it goes back to something that we touched on earlier, is that, you know, it avoids the process of where it's whiff, 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 hit, whiff, 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 hit, whiff, 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 hit, right? Every round matters.
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah, it's fast and it's nasty. And again, you know, don't discount your ability to throw a misfortune die or two into that. So I've got in front of me right here is John Jordan's online tool for Warhammer dice probabilities, and I'm showing a 72% chance to hit. So you got four characteristic dice against one challenge die. All right, this is the Ungor just taking a regular swing at a gun.
Yeah, and then the dwarf not using any active defense and no environmental factors.
Right. So if the dwarf does some active defense, if he brings one misfortune into play, that 72% drops by 10%. It goes from 72% to 62%. Two misfortune dice, you're almost even up. It's down to 53%. If you do the improved dodge and you've got two challenge dice instead of one, same thing. You're down to 51% at that point. So, you know, just having that one black die, really does in the long term from a probability standpoint, makes
quite
a significant
difference.
Change.
Yeah. And if you don't have the option to do dodge because you don't have sufficient skills or it's recharging, remember you can always, kind of going back to one of our older questions from last episode, use the environment to gain those benefits or impose those detriments on your opponents, because you see already how big of an effect it has.
And shouldn't it be easy to hit somebody who's not attempting to dodge you? I mean, and players need to remember that you can use dodge, parry, block all on the same turn as long as you fit the criteria.
I didn't know you could use all, like, combine them all into, like, one big, big defense.
Oh, for sure.
Oh, wow, that's cool. I like that.
You have to have a shield, you have to have a hand weapon, you have to have, if you
I think what happens is, especially, you know, new gamers, they just get so immersed in wanting to hack slash, and I think that they forego the, oh, that's right, I can dodge, or oh, that's right, I can parry. So I think it's kind of good to have people just hit the brakes, you know, and understand that there are multiple things you can do, you know, not just hack slash.
I found that in the podcast, in the live sessions, that when I started to use my things like assess the situation or parry, the other players started to realize, oh, I have these options available to me to, you know, increase my chances of not getting hit or, you know, taking a deep breath or whatever. Lots of stuff gets lost in this game. Like, a lot of people don't realize how many options just even the basic bog standard character has at their disposal.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think the more you play with more experienced players, you begin building on your repertoire of tools available to you. And a new player may only use a couple of the ones available, but each game they play, you know, they'll branch out a little bit more and experiment with the new tools they have.
Yeah.
So our next question is came in as an email to thereclessdice@gmail.com. Jim Moot Fever Hawkins, I can already tell he's a Halfling fan. I was in the Fantasy Flight forums the other day, and I came across a thread about the exclusion of Halflings as a playable race, at least until some additional content can be published. If this is true, then it feels like Fantasy Flight games don't really understand the game's setting. Halflings are an integral part of the Empire. Elves are very insular, especially high elves. If I were to travel the Empire, you would be far more likely to come across a halfling than a wood elf, and the chances of meeting a high elf would be very slim indeed outside of Marienburg or possibly Altdorf. So a little bit of a little less of a question and more of a statement, but what he's getting at is, you know, why do you think they chose wood elves and high elves as one of the core playable races, as opposed to something that's much more appropriate to the setting, being something like halflings? You know, why not halflings instead of high elves?
I personally have a bias against halflings, so I don't see it as a big deal
there's a love-hate relationship there for a lot of people.
I think out of everything that fantasy has ripped off from Tolkien, that's the one right there, is, you know, the little guys with no shoes. All right, fine, whatever. But I think it is, you know, from including the elves in really gives you that feeling of the other. The dwarves are the mainstay of having them in the empire. But I really think that, it gives you that capability to play those outsiders, to play the elves, especially, and the dwarves to some case, you know, part of that xenophobia of role playing in the empire that these guys aren't from here and they don't belong here. Halflings just seem kind of in the middle of that.
Well, what's interesting is that there are really only four playable races, maybe five if you include Bretonnia, as the core playable races that players can even use. I mean, you've got high elves, you got wood elves, you got humans, you've got dwarves, and you've got halflings. You've got Bretonnia is just another nation of man, but those are really the only playable races available in the Warhammer world for the side of good. So it's curious that they chose only to do four of those five at launch. Now, I would certainly expect halflings to be given a little bit of attention, probably in the distant future. But, you know, in the meantime, there have been a lot of players who have written up fan-based rules for developing halfling characters. We can include a link in the show notes. Currently, it's on page one of the house rules section on the Fantasy Flight forums. But a lot of people have put some good thought into it. Very well-rounded and very appropriately non-overpowered rules. So if you really want halflings in your adventures, they're there. I think Storm even comes with a halfling token.
Yeah, and Jay Little already said in one of the video, seminars or whatever that they had held, that they guarantee that the halflings will be addressed in the near future.
And they can't just exclude them. I mean, the Moot is a very large part of the Empire, or at least a very substantially important part of the Empire, and halfling culture in the Empire is also very important. So it's not like they're just going to disappear or be phased out of Warhammer fantasy roleplay. That won't happen.
I was kind of in the same sort of boat as the fellow asking the question here, because it did seem a little strange to me, being a fan of the lore for so many years, that they would include wood elves who are extremely, they're not just xenophobic, they will murder anything that comes into their land, and they stay in their forests. They don't really go out very often. So I think that had a lot of people really confused, and I think that was one of the harder things that Fantasy Flight Games had to explain about their decision-making process.
I was curious, why choose two elf races as opposed to a halfling and an elf?
Well, exactly, because you could have brought the wood elves in with a Bretonnia supplement.
You know,
and you bring the wood elves in and Bretonnia in at the same time.
Exactly. That would have made more sense to me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I guess they found that the mystique of those two races would probably have a little more widespread appeal, would be my guess on why they chose to go that route.
And I know a lot of people who like the wood elf characters too, like the wood elf flavor, the Native American kind of feel. So I already have at least three different characters made for that. So, or made of that race. So. Mm-hmm.
And what also is interesting to me, and what this guy touched on, is that, you know, the high elves, they're not even from the Empire. At least the wood elves are right next to the old, or in the old world, right adjacent to the Empire. But the high elves really don't have a major spot within the Empire outside of some embassies and traveling cultures and things like that. They're out on Ulthuan in the middle of the Atlantic. So, or the Warhammer equivalent of the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. So having them be a primary playable race, I think, is a little bit of an odd decision. But we'll move on to our last question here, and this one I was just thrilled with. This one's actually from the forums on the Fantasy Flight site, and I just decided to pull it on here because I was having a lot of fun discussing it and wanted to kind of keep it going with you guys. It's posted by R.A. Roger, Roger, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. He said, I've got the description in the Gathering Storm, but I still don't get it. What is a squig? What manner of beast is he? And I don't know why. And I just, I couldn't help it. Squigs are one of my favorite creatures in the Warhammer lore. So I thought I just opened up to everybody to kind of toss in their two cents on why you do or don't like squigs and to answer the question why.
The birds and the, let me explain to you the birds and the bees of the green skin race. See, I don't even know if they do that. I mean, back when I was in pretty heavy into the lore of things, they had the entire green skin race as the fungal race.
So let me touch on that for a second, because that is another currently running topic on the Fantasy Flight forums, which popped up immediately after this one, which is, you know, what's the deal with how orcs repopulate? I guess we can maybe get into both of those, because it's a pretty fun topic. Yeah. But continue, Paul, that the spores and the fungal aspect of it is kind of the core.
Yeah, the idea is that squigs are basically living carnivorous mushrooms. And that the greenskin races aren't far from that as well. So there's this whole symbiotic relationship that, you know, these fungal patches that create squigs, and the squigs are harvested by the goblins and the other greenskin races, that they're their primary food source. You know, it's kind of like like Fraggle Rock with radishes and doozer sticks, you know?
So I think the night goblins generally harvest the squigs and their bred in these, big pits, in I think it's Mount Gunbad, which is out in the World's Edge Mountains east of the Empire.
See, but that wasn't it back in the day. Back in the day, it was this whole life cycle of squigs and goblins and orcs and all that kind of stuff. And I know that they've kind of retconned it to back where the squigs are just these big red toothy maw things right now. But if I'm recalling correctly, I mean, there were different types of squigs. There were like cow squigs and.
Well, there are certainly squig models in the Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. Warhammer Fantasy Battle Tabletop. Some of the early squig models, if I recall, even have mushrooms growing out of their heads. But generally, just the description of a squig is a lot of fun. They're more teeth and claws than anything else. But they're generally like a big ball of skinny, fleshy mass with a giant mouth and huge teeth and big bouncing legs, kind of like a kangaroo with giant claws on it. And generally they hop around or roll. They don't really walk. Hence the squig hoppers from the tabletop games, where you might have a goblin who rides it, and I'm doing that in air quotes right now for those of you who are watching the video podcast. And you know, the goblin's along for the ride. The squig's really the one driving. It really encapsulates the comedy that is the dark fun comedy that Warhammer is kind of known for. So the squig and the orcs really are the heart of that.
The greenskins are the comedy element.
Oh, absolutely.
Sure.
I mean, I remember there's a model of a squig hopper, and this squig, you know, it's bouncing forward. It's ready to tear someone's head off. Meanwhile, there's a night goblin riding it, and he's actually riding it, and he's been turned around backwards, and his skirt's flying up, and he's got his little bare ass sticking out on top. It's hysterical.
And I've seen people model them where they have like the goblin's arm coming out of the mouth of the squig, representing, I'm assuming that the squig ate the goblin, you know?
Yeah, actually there's if you want to see models, no problem, just type in squig on the internet. If you want to actually see one in action, doing some cool stuff, the Warhammer, online, the Age of Reckoning, opening cinematic has actually a squig, and its handler, bouncing around doing quite a bit of stuff. What it does is not necessarily your traditional squig actions, where it actually swallows the goblin whole and he kind of like drives it from the inside by tugging on its tonsils. But nonetheless, it's pretty awesome and really cool. So definitely check that out if you haven't seen it. You can probably get it by typing in WAR, stands for Warhammer Age of Reckoning, opening cinematic.
Basically, I think what we're getting at is that greenskins do not sexually reproduce. It never talks about that in the lore.
There, I don't think there's any orc women.
Now, can I stop you right there? Because I might, you'll need to either correct me or come up with a creative explanation for why the orcs I'm about to tell you have giant boobs. In Blood Bowl, you can have orc cheerleaders. And these cheerleaders wear tutus. They have big boobs with giant metal caps on their nips, and they dance around. And but unless those are just orcs with man boobs, but I think those are female orcs.
But Blood Bowl's not canon, though, right? Blood Bowl is just
very much is. Yeah, it may seem out there, but it's very canon.
Yeah.
Now, I will agree with you. There are no female orcs. Now, I might get some flame for that. I don't know. I would probably argue that orcs are asexual and some just happen to have man boobs.
Yeah, that's my argument. In the newest book, the new Orcs and Goblins book, there's not one mention of, and any of the books I've read, of a female greenskin.
Let's just say that these orcs in Blood Bowl are, the cheerleading orcs are just really, they're like those guys who joined the cheer squad at in high school.
Yeah, they ate too many females. They got too much estrogen running through their body.
Exactly. So, squigs, all in all, they rock. They're awesome. There's really nothing not to like about them. They're hysterical.
I hear they taste good.
They do. The orcs and goblins use them for food, for cattle, for war machines, for really just about anything. So, have fun with them. They're meant to be very, very vicious, and they hop around, and oh, God, one of the biggest things, squigs are very uncontrollable. Generally, goblins are going to poke them around and try and get them to do what they want by stabbing them with a spear, or playing cymbals and things to try and make them go the other direction. But more often than not, squigs are eating anything they can. It is not necessarily bad guys. They will eat goblins and orcs just as happily. So make it, when you use a squig, don't forget to have some fun and make it eat a couple goblins as well.
Yes.
Always good advice to eat a couple goblins as well.
Exactly.
So. All right. So I think that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast. As always, please be sure to comment on the site. We're recklessdice.rorschach.net, or send us an email at recklessdice@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at recklessdice. And please do give us a review on iTunes. Give us a star review or write one up for it. We really appreciate the feedback from all those areas. So be on the lookout next week for the wrapping up of the Eye for an Eye scenario or adventure. And then we'll be back in 2 weeks with our next episode.
Good night,
everyone.
Good night, guys.
Good night. Thanks a lot.